right now, Iran is, you know, again in the news because Donald Trump wants to decertify it. He wants to get out of that agreement, just as he got out of the Paris Accord. And, you know, Iran is an old civilization. I've been there multiple times. I've done a book called Targeting Iran. I was last there this year, actually, a year ago this month or so. Since I've returned to the United States, I've been stopped at almost every airport checkpoint I go through for what is called secondary screening. And why? Because I went to Iran. And the questions are the same over and over again. Why did you go? Where did you go? Who did you talk to? Where did you stay? Etc. I talked to an immigration lawyer about this. They're just saying they're just waiting for you to make a mistake. And, you know, tell them a different name of a hotel than the one you actually told them, because they've got all of this in their computer. So it's just another example of trying to muzzle the press. You know, I went to Iran as a reporter to cover issues that were going on there, to talk to Iranians and see, you know, in terms of the Rouhani government, was he popular, unpopular? What is the actual power of the mullahs? What about the Revolutionary Guards and their influence? So I was doing my job, but apparently doing your job is not enough to, and this is under Obama, by the way, not under Trump, because I came back at the end of September 2016, and that's when I was detained the first time. So the airports, as I unfortunately like to say, are scare ports for me. They're areas of tension and anxiety. Flying out tomorrow from Madison, I hope there'll be nothing you'll read about in the Capital Times or here on WIDE. But it is very disturbing what's happening to journalists. Again, going back to India, a wonderfully independent, iconic journalist, Gauri Lenkesh. She had a weekly magazine, a patrika, in the Kannada language, which is official language of the South Indian state of Bangalore, Karnataka. The capital is Bangalore. She was murdered in front of her house a few weeks ago. The 23rd Indian journalist to be murdered in a recent time. This is in the world's largest democracy. And just on this past Monday, a very distinguished and honorable journalist was murdered in Malta. But she was investigating corruption, exposing corruption in that tiny island state. She was murdered. So there's enormous attacks on journalism coming from the highest levels of government, from Washington. When Trump denounces the media as the enemy of the people, that has a resonance, it has a redolent of words, you know, enunciated by Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda, you know, identifying the Jews and other communists as the enemy of the German people. So it's a very loaded and dangerous phrase to be tossing around. And just the other day, our exalted leader said he was disgusted by the press here. They write whatever they want. Yes, well, that's supposed to be the duty of the press under the First Amendment. You know, freedom of speech. But apparently, our exalted leader is not familiar with the Bill of Rights, or has a certain peculiar interpretation of the Bill of Rights that excludes investigative journalism, that excludes interrogation, that challenges conventional wisdom. So when things are going south, as they have been, when the polls are going south, and we're in an extremely dangerous moment, I believe, in our history and world history, in terms of the instability at the very top of the regime in Washington. When these poll numbers are going south, he drudges up, you know, these convenient enemies. And what I fear, of course, is the possibility of some military action, and then, you know, everybody rallies around the flag and our brave men and women in uniform who make the ultimate sacrifice, who are sent in harm's way by our commander-in-chief, and all that, all those formulas that come, you know, just erupting out of the mouths of the news anchors, even on NPR and PBS, the Petroleum Broadcasting Service, and National Propaganda Radio, who have, you know, kind of a, you know, decent, I would say, a reputation compared to other media, because, you know, there's no yelling. People are very polite. You know, you have David Brooks and Mark Shields giving you two supposedly opposite points of view. But yeah, they're opposite points of view if your range of opinion is from A to B. But if your range of opinion is from A to Z, it's not a, you know, a really lively debate. It's a very narrow debate. No, we shouldn't be bombing. What are we doing in Niger? Not even being talked about. And how did those troops get there? And how did ISIS spread to Niger? To Niger, it was a former French colony. And we learned that there are thousands of French troops in Niger as well. But I think, you know, to get back to Modi and some other issues, and to Donald Trump, it's part of what we see now of a shift to the right at the very top. Trump here, the election of Sebastian Kurz in Austria, an extreme right-wing candidate who's now probably become chancellor of Austria. There's Orbán in Hungary. There's Duda in Poland. There's Erdogan. How could I forget him, being an Armenian whose parents, you know, were thrown out of Turkey and, you know, came to the U.S. with just the clothes on their back. Erdogan in Turkey. It's part of a pattern, Sisi in Egypt, of more and more right-wing assertion, more and more right-wing aggression in the political sphere. And it's interesting that they're not coming to power, except for Sisi, out of the barrel of the gun. They're using the ballot box. So in France, for example, Marine Le Pen got 35% of the vote. This is La France, okay? The home of liberty, fraternité, égalité. This was almost three times the number of votes her father ever got, Jean-Marie Le Pen. So for Marine Le Pen to get 35% of the vote in France is very, very significant. There's the Brexit vote in England, a Catalan vote to leave Spain. All of these things are going on right now, I think, in the shadow of the collapse of neoliberalism. This economic doctrine, which was promising prosperity for all and a better life, it hasn't delivered, and there's been a huge backlash in a lot of these countries. Accompanying that backlash, of course, are demagogues who are only too willing to scapegoat minorities and others as the cause for their stagnant incomes or their falling wages, rising tuitions at public universities in Europe that used to be free, and things like that. So a huge surge in Islamophobia in this country and other countries around the world, scapegoating, anti-immigration feeling, anti-Mexican feeling, all of that going on, whipped up by demagogues. Now, it's not the first time it's happened, and, you know, again, knowing a little history, I think, is important. And actually, you can learn a lot from reading fiction. For example, about India, if you want to know about patriarchy and the caste system, read The God of Small Things. It's all there in Arundhati Roy's brilliant masterpiece. If you want to understand American fascism, read All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, which is kind of the fictional depiction of Huey Long of Louisiana, a demagogue who was promising a lot to the American, well, to the voters of Louisiana, and ultimately he was going to challenge Roosevelt in the 1936 election, but was assassinated in 1935. You can read Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, about what happens to a democracy that gets undermined, that gets eroded from within, and where charlatans are able to ride to power on the backs of immigrants and this wild kind of promises and sloganeering. There's right now, I mean, the number one book on Amazon is 1984, followed by Margaret Atwood's Tour de Force, The Handmaid's Tale, which is also a popular Hulu TV series. You might want to check that out. there's lots of examples, there's lots of manifestations in art, in poetry, in literature, of some of the things that I talk about. And I think art is very, very important to broaden our horizons, while also allowing us to enjoy the pure beauty of the word, how artists are able to craft beautiful sentences and project their imagery. Orwell's 1984 is well worth reading again, as is Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. You know, they have a kind of opposite point of view. In Orwell's view, in a totalitarian state, people are held in check by the threat of the gun, with the boot on the on your neck. And in Huxley's world, this is what Neil Postman talks about in Amusing Ourselves to Death. In Huxley's world, we censor ourselves, because we're so bogged down with trivia and distractions and the latest Kardashian divorce, or, you know, is George Clooney leaving his wife, and this scandal and that scandal, and sorry about Aaron Rodgers' broken collarbone. Will the Packers be able to bounce back and get into the playoffs? You know, getting into that those kinds of realms and ignoring important public issues. Now, Madison has a history of engagement, of confrontation, of being out there. And I'm telling people to get off of Facebook, as many of you have, and into the face of these legislators, into the face of these representatives, and turning up the heat in the streets so that the creeps in the suites will melt, who will fear us. There is nothing that scares them more than popular reaction, than rebellion. And that's why you've seen them cut back on their town hall meetings and having very orchestrated kinds of events, because people are out there and people are angry with what's going on. And so there's been a huge surge in activism, the growth of Indivisibility, Black Lives Matter, other organizations all across the country. And speaking of poetry and art and the great revolutionary, Emma Goldman told us that art has the power to make ideas felt. Art has the power to make ideas felt. This is a poem that I actually learned from the Progressive magazine, from its former publisher, Matt Rothschild. He brought this to my attention. It's called September 1st, 1939. It was written by W.H. Auden. It was the beginning of World War II. German troops crossed into Poland on this date. And Auden writes, "I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street," this is in New York, "uncertain and afraid as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade, waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I compose like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame." And I think at this moment in history, it's extremely important to show that affirming flame. And the great Canadian songwriter and singer Leonard Cohen passed away last year. In his very important song called Anthem, says, "Ring the bells that can still ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." So our role as part of a resistance, our role as people who believe in a democratic and just future, is to find those particular cracks. What seems to be a monolith of power, in fact, does have openings. And finding those openings and driving as much energy as we can into them and spreading them. Are they perfect, as Cohen says they're, indeed they're not. They are not perfect. And one of the things we have to overcome is our own internal sectarianism, where, you know, oh, I can't talk to him because, you know, he was against Trotsky, or this person, you know, thought Stalin was right. Forget those old arguments. People are not interested in those things anymore. We have to find common ground, and I think with the attack on Mother Nature, with the attack on the Earth, with the, you know, destruction of our planet, this pale blue dot in the universe that Carl Sagan called planet Earth, that should be a unifying figure. That's not a left-right issue if you think about it. Do you want your children to breathe healthy air? Do you want them to go to a park that's clean, that's not polluted? Do you want them to drink clean water, eat healthy food? Of course you do. No sane parent would want otherwise. So that's an issue that I think we can push forward on in a very hard way, and it's starting to happen with the growth of all of these different eco-organizations. Are we going to have questions? So that's a hint to wind up. Okay. I'm sorry I went on a little bit longer. I want to close with Frederick Douglass from the West India Emancipation Speech he gave on August 4th, 1857. If there's no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops, say men and women, who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its mighty waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And another poem very quickly from one of my favorite contemporary poets, Marge Piercy. I like her book called The Low Road. I've often used that poem. The moon is always female. But this is another poem she wrote recently for the Monthly Review called We Give Up Far Too Easily. Why do people get so discouraged about political action? You take vitamin pills and imagine that they do something. You don't say, I'll never wash dishes again because they'll just get dirty. We all mumble silly prayers into the air. Oh, please don't let me miss the plane. Oh, please let him call me back. Inaction certainly will work fine for the overlords who own our work. Inaction will certainly work fine for the overlords who own our work, control our lives, consider us collateral loss in their grand schemes. They only fear masses in motion. A little at a time is the way forward, an unending dance, two steps forward and one and a half back. Sitting on your ass too long makes you what? Thank you very much.
And while you're thinking of a question, actually, yes? August, speak up, please.
Yes, I've got a question about Russia today. We've got a number of very good lefties who are participating in Russia today, including Chris Hedges.
Yeah.
We've got Tom Hartman over there, Ed Schultz. There are people like Jesse Ventura, too, whatever, conspiracy mongers. But I've got some quiet with it. I'm not quite sure why they're there. You know the background of the radio world and the TV world, and why are they planting their feet in that terrain?
Well, in terms of Chris Hedges, I would never call him a conspiracy theory, quite the opposite.
Jesse Ventura sometimes travels.
Yeah, but I know Hedges personally. I've worked with him for a number of years, and I really respect and admire him very much. He does not have an outlet elsewhere to get his views out. So as far as I know, he has not been censored in any way on RT or has been interfered with by the editors there. In terms of the other voices that are on there, you mentioned Tom Hartman. He has a show on a lot of community radio stations and commercial stations as well here in the U.S. I don't know what motivates him except trying to reach a larger audience. I don't know, do people watch RT? I barely watched it myself. Any comments from people here? Do you think it's credible? Incredible? Partly credible. All right.
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes. Okay. Well, since while you're thinking of another question, and I want to bring Tariq Ali back into the discussion, his mother tongue is Urdu, and he's from the Pakistani city Lahore. He was born there before partition, and he grew up. His parents were communists. They were journalists. I had met his mother a few years ago, Tahira Ali, a very distinguished radical journalist. The great Urdu poet of the 20th century is Faiz Ahmed Faiz. It's kind of unusual. His first name and his last name is the same, F-A-I-Z. And Faiz was a journalist and proud of it. He was a union organizer, trade unionist and proud of it, a communist and proud of it. Had been, you know, served time in Pakistani jails when U.S.-supported military juntas were running the country, like Ayub Khan in the 1950s and other Zia-ul-Haq. And his greatest poem is called Bol. So you're going to learn a word, not just in Urdu, but a word in Hindi as well. It's the imperative, speak. So when you go to demonstrations in South Asia, even Bangladesh, Nepal, all over India, Pakistan, you see placards with these three letters, B-O-L, and everyone knows what it is. Oh, you mean the Faiz Ahmed Faiz poem. Let me read the poem. Pol ke lab, bol ke lab azad hai tere, bol zaban ab tak teri hai. Speak, your lips are free, speak, your tongue is still yours. Speak, there is little time, but little though it is enough time. Enough before the body perishes, before the tongue atrophies. Speak, the truth still lives. Say what you have to say, speak, your lips are free. Bol, bol, bol. That was for Tariq, who couldn't be here. Yes?
I just have this question about the conservatives and the people that speak for them and so forth. Do they really know what they're doing? Or are they just mouthpieces of the rich and just opportunists? Or what? I mean, you know, Trump talks about a tax cut for the middle class and gives you a tax cut for the rich. You know, he talks about improving health care and the same thing. Just more.
Yeah, you're asking me to go into to motivation.
How these demagogues, are they sincere but deluded? Or how do they reach such conclusions? That they think that they're doing something good.
Well, this has been part, I mean, the right wing has a long history in this country, and it's gone through various permutations, and this particular one is being funded by the likes of the Koch brothers and Rebecca and Robert Mercer and Sheldon Adelson and other billionaires who have a certain vision of the country. It's very much based on James Buchanan and this idea of libertarian economics. There should be no taxes. The market should decide everything. There should be no government intervention or regulation of any sort. All of these things, in their view, compromises real democracy. So it's not by accident. These gazillionaires have created propaganda machines. The think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the SCAFE Foundation, Middle East Institutes, the Near East Policy on Middle East Studies, all these right-wing Washington-based DC foundations and think tanks have access to the media, have created media. Fox is one example, talk radio, AM radio, Limbaugh and all of his imitators now since then. They've reached a lot of people with their constant messaging, constant. It's like an electronic Nuremberg rally. You repeat over and over again, you know, that build the wall, jail, what is not jail, Hillary? Lock her up and drain the swamp, repeat it over and over again. And it has an effect, but I think, you know, you're seeing now people waking up from dormancy and fighting back, and that's very encouraging. But as to their motivation, I think they want power, they want money. Whether they're sincere or really believe what they're doing, I can't answer a question like that. You know, you're going to motivation and inner feelings. Who knows? Maybe they're total hypocrites. Maybe they're left-wingers in disguise, but they're doing this for short-term profit. I don't think it's useful to speculate in that area. We have the evidence of what they're doing in front of us. Sir?
My question is about the Middle East. So you touched upon how Western powers like America and Britain have had a long-standing policy of supporting authoritarian regimes like the Saud regime in Saudi Arabia, or reinstating the Shah in Iran. Instead of supporting Arab nationalists, you'd rather see profits from oil go to developing their own countries. Do you think that Western support and like prominence of these authoritarian regimes who suppress free speech and mandate that their population subscribe to Islam is the reason why what may have started off to be fights for democracy recently in the Middle East have turned into, let's say, the Muslim Brotherhood in power in that's pretty much it. Why can't the Middle East form a democratic government?
Why can't the Middle East form a democratic governing structure? Well, U.S. policy has been militating against that, not just this year, but historically, going way back to 1945. Making agreements with potentates, with emirs and sheikhs, and other undemocratic rulers like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, who ruled that country longer than anyone since Ramses II. And he was declared by Hillary Clinton to be, you know, the greatest force for democracy in that country. So this was all part of the anti-communist hysteria post-World War II as well. Arab nationalists were depicted as, being pawns of Moscow, and they had to be resisted. And so there was an embrace of right-wing fundamentalist groups. I mean, that goes right up to the Mujahideen in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 1980s, where extreme fundamentalists, homicidal maniacs and drug traffickers were recruited by the U.S. To fight the Great Jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. The consequences of that action and intervention resonate today and are still with us and explain partly what's happened in various parts of South Asia and West Asia. And so take, for example, Iran, when the U.S. was strongly supporting the Shah between 1953, when he was reinstated, up until his fall in 1959. There was no secular opposition was crushed. The communists, leftists, trade union organizers, intellectuals were either executed or exiled or, you know, imprisoned for years on end. The only group that was allowed to function literally were the fundamentalists. In the case of Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so that crushing of a secular opposition left only one really challenge to state power, and that was the Muslim Brotherhood. But the role here of the U.S., I don't want to, you know, excuse the responsibility of Arab states for their own destiny, but this, you know, you're intersecting a lot of what happened at the end of World War I with the drawing of those boundaries that I mentioned, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the splitting up of the Kurds into four different countries, the drawing up of other, you know, lines in the sand. We may be seeing the end of that, actually, right now, or the beginning of the end of that with the Kurdish vote in Iraq, but that remains to be seen how that plays out. But it's been the fear of communism that drove U.S. policy to embrace Muslim fundamentalists who were anti-communist, because communism was seen as tantamount to atheism, thus had no legitimacy among that particular sector of opinion. But Sisi in Egypt is one of the worst of the lot. The situation in that country is, you know, extremely bad. There's still many, many people being imprisoned, human rights basically brushed aside, and, you know, warmly embraced as by Trump as a great leader. You'll have to shout out, it's hard to see. Bowl. Yes.
David, so you said that the only place that Chris Hedges can have a voice is on RT. And I think it's an interesting situation that, you know, you yourself started in community radio at KGNU in Boulder. You've been running alternative radio for 32 years. The only kind of government-funded broadcasting in the United States, NPR and PBS, 50 years old this next month, is under threat from the Trump administration. How can these other voices get out in contradiction, in opposition to the Fox Newses and the Rush Limbaughs that have so much money coming from the right?
Well, there have been some positive developments. I mean, you mentioned, you know, AR celebrating 32 years, Democracy Now, 22 years, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting in New York. The growth of The Intercept as a force, I think, is very significant. That's co-founded by Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, you know, a very important source of independent, progressive information. You know, do look at that particular website. There's Truth Out, Truth Dig, lots of, you know, websites that provide alternatives to the kind of the corporate generated machine that's out there. Certainly, last but not least, is the Progressive Magazine, The Nation, other sources of information. Hedges, incidentally, I've done maybe 10 or 11 programs with him, so he certainly has a voice on alternative radio, as does Richard Wolff and other radicals you may have heard of, like Vandana Shiva, David Corton. So we're doing our best out there to present independent thought and to get those views and perspectives out to a larger audience. But realistically speaking, we don't have much money. I mean, there is, you know, in a capitalist economy, that's where we are operating in. I can't take out full-page ads. I can't take out, you know, spots on during CBS program, you know, Real Housewives of Atlanta or Real Housewives of Malibu. I can't do any of those things. So, you know, it's rather limited. But I think, you know, dance, as the great philosopher Muhammad Ali said, dance like a butterfly but sting like a bee. Be as agile and as nimble and as economical as you possibly can be in terms of getting the word out there. And I think if you don't allow yourself to get discouraged and to kind of fall into despair and depression, you can do it. I mean, I had no background. I mean, for some of the younger people here in the audience, I was absolutely raw. I had no idea what I was doing. I made enormous mistakes. One of my most famous techniques was not turning on the microphone of the guest I was interviewing. So after a while, you know, people were stopping me in Boulder and they were asking me, was this some kind of like Zen technique that you were practicing to, you know, imagine what the person was saying but never hearing their voice? So that was, you know, until I overcame those, you know, silly mistakes and erasing tapes, jamming tapes, not loading them correctly, and all those kinds of mistakes that I did make, I figured it out, and I started doing it against, you know, all of these odds and with no money whatsoever. Yes?
What is your opinion of globalism?
Of globalism?
Yeah.
By that, do you mean global trade or one world?
Yeah. it's a term that is used quite frequently, and it means more or less a centralization of countries.
A centralization of countries. Well, I think in terms of what's happening with climate change and that planetary crisis that we're facing, there has to be collective action. How that action, otherwise we're doomed. You know, if Bangladesh has the best, you know, environmental policy in the world and nobody else is following that, it doesn't help us very much. Or if the Ivory Coast has a great, you know, environmental policy. We need global collective action in certain areas, certainly. But I get from your tone that, you know, you view this with some trepidation or suspicion?
To a degree. I mean, there is a book out on globalization versus, maybe it's capitalism. I don't know, because capitalism has taken over completely.
Capitalism of a peculiar variety, because there are many socialist aspects to the current system of capitalism that we live under, various subsidies and, you know, government bailouts that, you know, real orthodox capitalism would not allow. So it's a kind of quasi capitalism that we have here and in other countries as well. But I'm not too worried about that in terms of loss of sovereignty, because I think that's an overblown issue. We have to think of ourselves as planetary citizens, not just as members of particular tribes. So, you know, they're Canadians, we're Americans, never the twain shall meet. You know, I think overcoming that is something we could, you know, strive for. Yes?
Everyone knows that the religious rights in America is a very large component of the political scene nowadays. And there's a polarity, generally speaking, not 100% by any means, but generally speaking, a polarity between the progressive thought and movement and so on and the religious right. What hope is there for a genuine dialogue in the spirit of conversation?
What hope is there for a spirited conversation between the religious right and everybody else?
Progressives.
Good. Okay, so what are the possibilities? Well, I think, first of all, we have to go where people are, not where we want them to be. So would I like people to be familiar with Gramsci? Of course. Would I like them to be familiar with alternative radio and the work I do or the Progressive Magazine? Of course. But, you know, most people are not there. So we have to go where people are, and we have to find a voice that's not condescending, that's not pedantic, that is straightforward, and that is fact-driven. Now, there are certain elements, and I've met them, you know. Colorado Springs is not very far from Boulder, which is kind of like a center of Christian fundamentalism, certainly in the Rocky Mountain region, focused on the families there and other evangelical churches that have moved to Colorado and specifically to that community. There are some people that simply will not hear facts, that are not interested or cannot hear rational arguments. And so I think at some point, and, you know, I think we all experience this maybe with family members or friends, you know, you try, but after a point, I think you have to make an editorial decision, you know, and cut and say, you know, I've tried, you know, and I've done my best, but, you know, maybe you should read Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, and, you know, understand what's going on in the country today with the rise of neo-Nazism and extreme thinking, and the rise of authoritarian rule and totalitarian trajectories that are pretty evident in various sectors as well with all the surveillance. So I would try, but, you know, people who believe that 2 and 2 is 5 are very hard to, it's very hard to unconvince them of that. So you try and move on.
Thank you. That's a good answer. Thank you.
Yes.
This is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, I am kind of serious, too. If Hillary would have visited Wisconsin, do you think she would have won the presidency?
If Hillary would have visited Wisconsin, would she have won the presidency? I can't say. I don't know, you know, the politics here well enough. I'd say, off the top of my head, I'd say probably. Precisely. I think the hostility to Corbyn is deeply rooted in the Times editorial room. He's regarded as an outlier, someone who's very dangerous to conventional politics, who utters words like National Health Service and other examples of socialist policies, and it probably frightens them. So he's gotten short shrift. But mind you, Theresa May has been such a disaster that they've been kind of backpedaling on Corbyn of late and presenting him in a more favorable light, at least in some of the news reports. Yeah, I mean, the Times, you know, right now is very critical of Trump because, in their view, he's undermining American power and the American order in the world, and that is anathema for the New York Times and for the establishment. They want to continue with Pax Americana, and that whole structure is being threatened by Trump. So they see, you know, the uprooting of alliances and various agreements as very dangerous to the order that they largely constructed after the end of World War II in 1945. There's still a lot to be learned in the Times. I mean, I read it every day, and, you know, like Chomsky says, usually there's some nugget on page 27 in the last paragraph that you didn't know about that's very important. Yes, thank you all very much for coming, and take care. Don't despair, Carol.